We made this.
And welcome to The Time Is Now, Soylent Green is People. And this is our coverage of Millennium's Season 3. And this week, we shall be looking at collateral damage. It is mid-season, episode 11, and it was written by Michael R. Perry, directed by Thomas J. Wright, the ever-present. And it aired on the 22nd of January, 1999. And as always, we always have a guest on the Time Is Now. And this week is no different. And this week, we have Chris Knowles. Chris, how are you doing, mate? How are things going?
Going great. Going good. Really glad to be back. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you're going to be on next week as well with The Sound of Snow. So it's nice to have a bit of a double header. Darren will be joining us next week for what hopefully will be a fantastic episode. And I'm looking forward to doing that. But we're right in the middle season. It's episode 11. So there's 22 episodes this season. What are your general thoughts of season three overall up until this point, then up to the halfway point?
Well, I think it. There were a couple spotty episodes in the beginning there, but I think at this point it's really hitting its stride. You know, it's just really doing things that I've never seen before in television. And I think the machine, you know, was a little creaky, a little rusty for a little bit there. But I think by this point it's really, you know, firing on all cylinders. So.
Yeah, I mean, with this one in particular is a highlight for me. I really like this, and it's a memorable one. Not only just the fact it's James Masters, but the actual episode itself, I think, is strong. It comes at an interesting time because there's like a block of four where they kind of talk about season two, season one, Catherine, and the like. So I really do like that. But what would you rate this out of 10 for you then? Where does this fall within the season three list of episodes? How high would it be for you?
Oh, I think this is one of the best. I would give this a 9.
Yeah. Yeah, I would be up there as well, probably an 8.5, 9. The IMDb rating, as we always have a quick look at, is 7.9, and that's from 201 votes. And it's a really strong episode. It's nice to see that, again, Thomas J. Wright directing. I think there's some lovely touches in this episode, actually, with some of the scenes and some of the camera work that's done, especially during the James Masters Eric Swan and Taylor Watts' scenes. I think that some of the work there is really good. But should we dive in and then start talking about the episode?
Sure thing.
Let's go and do it then. We don't find out who the girl is until after the credits. But what did you make to the opener? Because it is a fairly standard procedural opener, but I think it's a solid one.
Well, I was wondering if that bowling alley was like the same bowling alley they used in Elegy. That's like how my brain works. Like, you know, I just see a scene like that, and I'm like, oh, okay. You know, I don't think there are a lot of bowling alley scenes in the 10-13 canon. So I just sort of, you know, I just made that little connection. I think it's very strong. You know, I was kind of surprised on first blush, you know, how that all went down.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you knew something bad was going to happen, you know, you weren't really sure. Yeah. You weren't really sure what exactly it was going to be. So yeah, I really thought that was very effective.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that we'll park for now, but we'll talk about later. And I think the things for me that you wouldn't necessarily catch on first viewing is the way that Taylor reacts, and we'll talk about that right at the very end of the episode. But also the the preparedness of the characters to abduct her as well. The fact that it's kind of an operation, a military operation, which obviously works quite well. But as a plain opener, it does have this kind of, not necessarily serial killer, but sort of the season one vibe of, you know, girl gets kidnapped. And I like that, you know, that there is that feeling that we are getting to some point around that. It feels like it's a classic kind of millennium opener. It stars Brendan Fair as well, who has been in a few things. He was in The Pest House as well, strangely enough, back in season two. He was also in, strangely enough, I was watching, I'm a U2 fan. I was watching, U2 have been celebrating their, I think it's the 20th anniversary. It's the 20th anniversary of All That You Can't Leave Behind.
Oh, Jesus. Don't even tell me that.
Yeah, I know. It's that long ago. And they've been releasing videos, like HD re-releases of their videos from the time, and some from their holiday villa in Ease in South of France. And this week, or last week, they actually showcased the US version of Stuck in a Moment That You Can't Get Out Of. And who would jump up? Brendan Fair. He's the goal kicker in the video, which I thought was quite ironic that it happened only last week. So I thought it was good.
Well, let me just interject here for a second and tell you that I saw you two on the October tour.
Okay,
so that's going on 40 years now. So when you tell me that they're doing the 20th anniversary of like an album that I just thought like came out yesterday, that's a little unsettling for me.
I apologize. just wait till we get the I went to the 30th anniversary of Joshua Tree, but that was a few years back, but it's all good. So there's this idea that the military style takedown, second unit kind of comes in, you know, he gets zapped as such with the taser. It's a lovely way to finish the end of the opening scenes, really, and we head into the main titles. We kind of get a general opening with like McLaren doing his usual thing, and because he's been doing this quite a lot over the course of the season. Now, McLaren comes up a couple of times in this episode, probably more than he does in most. His kind of like discussion and this hedging around the fact it's Peter Watts' daughter that we come to realise. What do you think to this kind of opening where we've got the fact that Frank declined and that, you know, Hollis is obviously kind of pushing McLaren a little bit, the fact that the Millennium Group wasn't even mentioned, that it's almost like a reluctance to even bring up the name Millennium?
Well, I think that, you know, that's clearly sensitivity towards Frank's feelings, but, you know, yeah. Andy does sort of dress him down because he doesn't really buy into Frank's theories about the Millennium Group. And I think he sort of uses this opportunity to express his skepticism, let's just say, about Frank's take on the group. So it's interesting too, because you really see this been like some sort of, not necessarily confusion, but like, how are we supposed to regard Peter Watts? And, you know, your sympathies are going to be naturally with him, you know, no matter what you've been led to think about the character, because of what, you know, is a pretty universal human situation that I think most people would be sympathetic towards.
Yeah, it's an interesting choice at this time as well, because as I say, we're halfway through the season. We've got, you know, what happened in Skull and Bones, which we'll come back to shortly, because it does get mentioned, Skull and Bones, at a later date. But the fact that we've got McLaren kind of trying to be, you know, it's family, the fact that, you know, we need to sort this out. Let's get the team behind it. Let's sort this out, and it gives a nice little three-way with Frank, Emma, and Peter moving forward within the episode. And again, there's a number of different scenes in this where it really kind of jumps out at me that the writing is really good on this one. But what I will say is I think just before we get into the Frank, Emma, and Peter stuff is I wanted to talk about Taylor's scenes on the table, because they're probably the most visceral that I can remember in the series as a whole. It always gets me, these scenes with her. I think that she does such a good job there, Jacinda Barrett. She does such a good job portraying Taylor Watts. And the actual rub down and everything going on, as I say, some of the Dutch angles that the camera moves into, and some of the real kind of visceral reaction that it comes from me. I don't know if you felt that as well, but it is the scenes throughout the whole episode really kind of play to that, what you were saying before about playing to that universal kind of feeling of the fact that this is someone's daughter.
You really get, since we don't know what the story is going to be at this point, you're really in classic first season Millennium world. It almost seems like we're really back to the basics, psychotic, abductor, and this whole whole washing down thing almost kind of gave me like a Donnie Faster vibe, So almost really going back to the, to the roots of the series. So It's very disconcerting, and the way it's shot, it almost has this kind of Kubrickian objectivity. That cold, sterile room, and the camera work just makes it all the more cold and sterile, which I think makes Taylor's reaction, all the more upsetting in a way,
And they obviously bring back the Polaroid photograph, which is obviously a staple mark of Millennium as well, which, was a nice touch, and the fact that it's Peter getting those Polaroids rather than Frank is a nice little reflection reversal for the episode as well. The fact that, within the episode, we actually, Frank actually physically says, about the ransom, and the fact that Frank's, he's clever enough and understanding enough of, like, well, the ransom is there. It's just it's not being shown to us. And I do like that aspect of, we're not being told the whole story, but the reflection of Frank as well.
All that really does is, since we know this is Peter's daughter, and we see this horrible scene in this cold storage room or whatever it is, I'm not exactly sure what you would call it, but it's very disconcerting. We don't know where we are. We don't know what's happening. We don't know why, this girl is abducted. The whole feeling that, I'm just trying to think back when I first watched it, and it really did give me this almost like Alice in Wonderland horrible kind of, very like, what's going on, where am I, terrible uncertainty and a feeling of just dislocation, I think would be the best way to put it. And I think that a show like Millennium, with what it wanted to do and what it claimed to be, that's the feeling that I think it should instill,
Yeah, and it does a really good job of that, actually, now you say it, because there's a great way in storytelling, as you say, with the sterile stuff and the cleansing stuff, and the fact that, hardly a word is said when he's dressing her down, and when he is scrubbing her and things like that, that uneasiness, that trepidation that the audience has, because it's kind of like, well, what is happening? Why is this happening? Why Peter? And obviously, we know it's aimed at Peter, so we do have an indication that something is connected, and it's bound to be about the Millennium Group, but we just don't know why this is happening. Well, we don't even know it's about the Millennium Group at that time, because you're thinking, is it just a random thing? But obviously it comes to fruition that it isn't. But Peter Watts or Terry O'Quinn's portrayal of this, in this unenviable position between the two worlds, it really kind of adds another colour to the episode as well, because he looks uncomfortable. He's having to, really, I mean, when he's speaking to McLaren, for example, and they're asking about the Millennium Group members, and he's asking about I don't disagree with you, there's issues, policy and things like that. He really is torn between, his daughter and the group, and that is something that we've had in the past, but this really kind of brings that out. And I like that we're actually getting another story focused on Peter for that reason, because we've seen at the end of season two, you know, he kind of disappears, and you know, when he comes back into season three, we've got the whole Mabius thing and everything else is going on. But it is nice to, if nice is a good word to say it, but it is nice that we've got an episode here which plays on that plays on his allegiance to the group, like we've seen in some of the back end of season two.
Well, the other thing that I want to you know, point out with the whole Peter Watts angle is that you really get the sense of, like, you know, again, trying to put myself back in, you know, the head of somebody who hasn't watched this episode several times, but I'm really kind of thinking, like, it almost seems like poetic justice somehow. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
if you have no reason to believe that, like, Taylor is not going to die in this situation, you know, there's every reason to believe that this is the end for her. And yeah, there's almost like sort of an inference, and maybe it's just like that POV storytelling, but it's almost like an inference, like, you know, you're getting what you deserve. And you always get the sense that Frank feels that way.
Yeah. And it's not beyond the realms of possibility as well, is it? Because it's most stories, like procedural stories, that you would get something like this. You kind of expect that the girl will be saved. And I don't really get this from that. You're right with that, because there is an amount of tension and an amount of peril, because it's a character we've not really seen before, and it's about Peter and where Peter's been in the past has always been a bit murky. So the fact that, you know, this is quite up until this point in the episode, it's quite possible that this is going to have dire consequences. I don't think Millennium was really that afraid to go there if they needed to. Obviously, it goes a different way in this one. But it is nice that you do have that feeling that this could go anyway, and I think that the episode really does well for that.
Well, 10-13 is notorious for killing off characters that you grow, you know, very accustomed to, and in this case, this is somebody who's introduced for this episode. You know, this is, again, no reason to assume that this is not poor Taylor's end. You know.
Yeah. Exactly. So a couple of things, actually, as we move into the episode, there's some great Frank and Peter moments. I mean, the scene at the house where you've got Frank obviously doing his investigative work, and then obviously outside the psychiatric hospital, that those two scenes kind of bookend the thirds of the episode in some ways. But just by the look, the kind of the angst and the tension that's drawn between them is really well played. And what did you make to both that scene and later on when we're talking about not necessarily the specifics, but the fact that Peter needs to ask Frank for that help, and the fact that, you know, they've got to come together at this point?
Oh, I think it's it seems so excruciating for Peter, and because when we've seen him, you know, we saw him with the destruction of the Homer Petey house and Skull and Bones, and he's just a sinister character in the fact that, you know, the worst sinister characters are the characters who believe they're the most morally justified, you know? And then our first sort of sense of him in the season is when he just shows up at Jordan's school, right? And that's very intimidating. That's clearly intimidation and threats. You know, I know where your kid goes to school. So Peter is a fascinating character. And I think it's among a lot of Millennium fans, I think it's really underappreciated and misunderstood what he was being portrayed as here. Because again, just don't forget that whole POV ethic, that storytelling ethic that these people were absolutely preoccupied with. So every time we see Peter, we're kind of seeing him through Frank's eyes, right?
Yeah.
So I think that you know, that Frank is kind of crazy to begin with and kind of paranoid, obviously, that the way he's seeing Peter is not necessarily the way Peter exists or how other people would see. That's the interesting thing, because Andy would not see Peter that way. And Emma is starting to see Peter that, well, certainly at this point she's going to, but you know, she didn't really have, she wasn't fully paranoid about him until after Skull and Bones. And that, certainly that scene, the Love Hurt scene. So I just think it's, you know, again, it's a level of story, it's a level of storytelling that I think is not necessarily your kind of genre, you know, your typical genre material, your typical Friday night death slot material. It's very, I think it's very subtle in advance, and maybe it just went over a lot of people's heads on first glance, because you really have to kind of rewatch it and think about everything and think about how this episode stands in relation to all the other episodes to get a sense of what exactly it is you're watching.
This one echoes, and this is considering what happened in the opening, which feels very much like a season one episode, and the glances that we get, and I'll go back to that in a second, but I just wanted to concentrate on the scene where we actually do get Peter and Frank together, because there's the way that Frank walks out and kind of shrugs his shoulders as he leaves the psychiatric hospital, like, I've got to go and face this now. And as you say, the point of view storytelling, it's interesting to say that. I was being talking about to someone recently, kind of a bit of a psychological thing, in a management style of, you know, like listening to somebody, say if they've got a complaint, and how people understand it, but by validating what they've said, because sometimes what their story of events is completely different to what someone else's version of events are, but which one's more valid? It's valid to the person. So it was really interesting, you know, talking about the point of view storytelling that 10-13 do. But this scene with Frank talking to Peter has all the hallmarks of previous discussions that we've had. The fact that it is great TV in my eyes. The fact that, you know, Peter uses his techniques, or tries to use his techniques that he's used in the past, and you know, Frank will come retort back saying, "Don't flatter me, it's another lie." Which in the past, in the Owls and Roosters episode, it's very kind of similar to that. But Peter actually retorts back, which is not something we've seen before. And then obviously the plea comes out with that, the fact of "Please help me" kind of thing, and he says, "Stop asking questions I can't answer." So there's this indication, obviously, where we're going with the rest of the season, that Frank knows where the line is, Peter knows where the line is, and it's the fact of, you know, this is more personal. I don't want the group to know. I just want my daughter back. And I think it's a great scene, that.
Yeah, again, this is an unusual television. This is not the kind of thing that you would see on Law and Order or something, or CSI. This is intentionally difficult. And I think that's, at this point in time, you know, when this series is not getting very much attention, right? I think that's really kind of brave, but it also seems like they were very liberated. You know, they were very liberated by the fact that nobody was expecting anything of them. And it was, I don't know when they realized that it was going to be the end of the series. Maybe they just, you know, from the jump, they just said, okay, well, this is just the bonus round, you know? And I think that because of that, you know, you had these just unbelievably phenomenal episodes of television. Like the three that I would really pick out, aside from the final two, which to me are just absolutely mind-boggling, they would make like one of the best thriller movies you'd ever seen if they were cut together. But the ones I always think of is this one, The Sound of Snow, and Darwin's Eye. That this is just like, this is just next level television. And I just really get frustrated that people overlook this. And I'm glad that Darren's finally sort of come around, because I just keep thinking like, Darren, what do you know, this is like right up your street, man. This is like, you could just chomp on this for hours, you know? And finally, you know, I think it's just a little bit of you know, fanboy loyalty that we needed to break through, but I'm glad that he's really starting to figure it out, you know?
Yeah. Anything we can do to bring Darren aboard, that'd be great. You know, he's got his own mind, but you know, we can wear him down. And I think I'm the same with a couple of people that have been listening to the podcast as well, that they've said that, you know, upon listening to the episode so far, that they are having a newfound either reevaluation of it, which I think is fantastic. If we can draw more people into season three, then yes, and we're not fanboying all over the place with it. We know we'll definitely have a critical analysis of it, but there is a lot to love in season three. I did like just a quick note on McLaren and Frank's discussion when they are talking about Frank shooting from the sidelines, you know, sniping from the sidelines. I like the use of the word snipe, because obviously it has connotations for the episode, but the fact that you know, we've got Frank who's dillying around, who knows that there's something, you know, he's empathic enough to understand that this is a crime that's being committed on an innocent at the end of the day, that he does need to help. And I do like that he's circling around, you know, but being very kind of coy about it. And also the fact that, you know, Frank is able to put on his glasses on to, like, sort of say, you know, and I love the section with Emma and Frank on that bit where he says, let's, like, forget it's Peter Watts, let's just think high value target. Let's talk about the actual element, why this person's being made. I love that bit. And I think it's a testament to the writing on how it works. But the Millennium Group in this episode and what they kind of represent and what they do within this episode. I mean, the group's role is, you know, the control that they have, the message that, you know, the message to the members that they have to toe the line, especially with that gunshot wound to the head, which is obviously a callback to Skull and Bones, where Emma sort of goes, well, this is exactly what this, we've seen this before. And then the non-committal of Peter in that area, when Emma is kind of directly pointing out, you know, it's, you know, this is the Millennium Group, is really a really nice connection. But talk about the Millennium Group as a whole in this, because it's not only is the fact of the warning Peter, don't break lines, don't break the company policy. The discussion with the syndrome, the Gulf War syndrome, and how it intertwines with the Marburg virus and the kind of the Gulf War and what happens to Eric Swan. What do you make to the intertwining of all that?
Well, I am glad you asked, because I looked this up. I got to tell you something. I could not find it for the life of me, but maybe it's on a disc somewhere, but I remember there was a post floating around Usenet that was almost this exact same plot line. And right. I think it was a year or two earlier, but it was this whole thing, you know, about friendly fire and, you know, intentional live staging of bioweapons tests. But it's very interesting, the timing of this, because so this aired in late January, right?
Yeah, 22nd of January, 99.
Yeah, 99. So 2 months before, a doctor by the name of Garth Nicholson had given testimony to the United States Senate about investigations being done on Gulf War syndrome. And he had argued that it was a particular pathogen called Mycoplasma incognitus, which is, you know, sounds like a like something you'd see on the X-Files, right? Yeah. So I'll just read you this quote directly. With a technique called gene tracking, Dr. Garth Nicholson at the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas, discovers that many Desert Storm veterans are infected with an altered strain of Mycoplasma incognitus, a microbe commonly used in the production of biological weapons. Incorporated into its molecular structure is 40% of the HIV protein coat, indicating that the virus had been man-made. Now, also at the same time, so this isn't not just like a conspiracy theory. This is, you know, this is a doctor from a, you know, a well-known hospital who's giving testimony to the United States Congress, right? So right. Then at the same year, this is in 94, I mean, Nicholson had given the testimony to the Congress, the Oversight Committee on the Congress 4 years later, but this is back in 94. But Senator Jay Rockefeller had issued a report, you know, just detailing the fact that the military had subjected hundreds of thousands of military personnel in human experiments and exposure to mustard gas, nerve gas, ionizing radiation, hallucinogens, viruses, bacteria, and of course the famous example of the Trinity testing site, you know, with the exposure to nuclear weapons and so on. So this is how plugged in these guys were. So I don't know if Michael Perry saw, you know, a news story on this testimony before Congress and then just started writing the story. I mean, it seems a little bit of quick, yeah. quick turnaround. I think that it really goes to show you that this season in particular is very, very well researched and really gets into some of the real nitty gritty of, you know, what I call parapolitics. I don't like the term conspiracy. I think it's kind of a stupid term. And I always like, you know, prefer to refer to corruption. You know, conspiracy yeah. is just like, it's almost like a metaphysical term. You know, I prefer the whole idea of, you know, governmental corruption. And then the concept of parapolitics of like all the things that are happening behind the scenes. So these guys are really plugged into this. And I know for a fact that they were reading some like really hardcore stuff, not just like Alex Jones kind of stupidity. They were really reading, you know, the nitty gritty, the reports, you know, all the stuff that the media covered up and everything like that. So that's why I am just, when I first watched the season, it was just like, are you kidding me? Like, this is what we're doing now? Like, this is like, seriously? And it was like yeah. one thing after another. I was like, I couldn't believe it. It's like, oh my God. So these guys were really plugged in to some really fascinating underground or, you know, not commonly publicized sources of information. And of course, the X-Files did a lot of this stuff as well, so.
Yeah, well, I was going to mention that actually. With I know that this is probably going to be reverse order. This is very meta, but that you've mentioned in the past and probably in your writings as well about the left turn that season six took, and you could quite easily rewrite this for an X-File, but it's it definitely goes down that well and uses that, but it does so in a way that, you know, as you say, that the. You mentioned about the government thing. I mean, obviously, Millennium, even though the group itself are ex-FBI technically, but it's not quite corporate kind of you know, takeover or anything like that or dealing with. But obviously, having the subject matter and incorporating into the group is really interesting. What did you make to you mentioned Alex Jones there, but what did you make to the introduction of Art Bell and that you know, the way that it's written to bring out Eric Swan's character, the fact that he was going, because you mentioned about some of the stuff on the wires and over the internet and stuff, because that's what they use later on. But what did you think to the use of Art Bell in this episode to actually bring the killer out, and not the killer, bring Eric Swan out? Because it's very similar to what happens in 522666 in some ways, but it's just interesting that they're using this conspiracy radio talk show element of the show to bring that into the fall, really.
Oh, I thought it was brilliant, and it was just so timely. I mean, this is really the height of Art Bell's influence and popularity, and this is really a time when that show, I think it was the most listened to show on the radio in America, and right. you know, not only in America, but you know, North America, maybe even other countries as well. I mean, it was really big, and everybody was listening to it. And there were all these kind of crazy things that sort of came out of that, like, for instance, Heaven's Gate, right? So, I mean, Heaven's Gate was directly, they listened to an episode of Art Bell and sort of took that as their cue to, you know, leave their vessels. So it's just, the thing that's so great about this episode is that it is very much of its time, but it's also not of its time. I mean, there's no reason that you could not watch this episode and not think that it was made last week. You know, there's nothing about it that, I mean, maybe some of the little technical details, I'm not sure, but you know, there's nothing about it. And you know, the interesting thing too, is that having James Marsters, you know, there's always this whole thing where like the X-Files and Buffy the Vampire Slayer were sort of like almost like sister shows in a way, like they're sort of running on this parallel track, and you had a lot of crossover in the fan communities. And at this point in time, this is before the Spike character really becomes a regular. He's just sort of like this recurring villain at this time. So I thought it was really brave of James Marsters to take on this role. And it just shows, you know, I think his performance is absolutely phenomenal.
Well, it's interesting because it was something I noticed actually, that he didn't get a guest starring role on it. So I didn't realize it was, I obviously going back, I didn't realize it was, he was not quite there with Spike. You know, I assumed that he was guest starring because of that. But obviously if that's not the case, then yeah, that would make more sense to the way that there it is.
But you know, it's just you know, all I just want to say is that, you know, this is a time when you know, Buffy is really becoming big in the culture, and Art Bell is really big in the culture. So, you know, at the same time, it, to me, it's like practically timeless. It also is like just a really brilliant time capsule of that moment in time, you know.
I mean, during the Art Bell kind of radio station scenes, Frank, and it's interesting, this for the four episodes that surround it, you've got All Murder, Borrowed Time, this, and then Sound of Snow next, all of which are, you know, really solid, strong episodes. And they all touch upon the Catherine element. And the way that it's brought in here, that of this conspiracy, everything that's kind of a boiling pot for Frank, and it's almost like a release for him in this. But, you know, those four episodes that I've mentioned, the fact that, you know, the season as a whole is really starting to, you know, percolate with all of this kind of, this stuff that's going on around Jordan and Catherine, is a really testament to how strong the season was getting at this point.
Oh, yeah. Again, I mean, an undiscovered gem in the history of television. You know, I think that if you're an X-Files fan, you know, that leans more towards the more serious side, you know, the sort of earlier old school type of X-Files. I mean, I think the season is right up your alley. You know, I think it's just, it's a great companion. And again, I mean, it took a little while to pick up a good head of steam, just because there was some backstage confusion with, you know, Duggan and, Horton and Chip, you know, all just not really too sure what's going on. But again, like once you get past 13 years later, you're just into some really phenomenal television that I just, I think is important television. I know that's kind of like making bold statements for something that most people don't pay attention to. But I think that, you know, a lot of people were watching these episodes and just picked up on it. You know, for instance, CSI, you know, and maybe even 24 a little bit too. I mean, I just think that the tone that they struck and just the balance of all these different elements that really maybe shouldn't even go together, that they made work in tandem. I think it was very influential, even though if it's not well known in the general public.
Yeah, yeah, and I think it's something that we've attested to quite a few times over the time as now as well. What about Eric Swan then? We mentioned James Marsters. James Marsters plays Eric here. It's this is a desperate act for him. It's something he's wanting to be understood. He's kind of holding the blame as such for the atrocities that happened over there. It's an interesting story in itself, even giving up all the stuff that you've mentioned before with the you know, the trials and the friendly fire and all that aspect of it. But his actual story is something of interest, and I think that, you know, James Masters does a really good job with not, I'm not saying it's very little to do, because there's a lot within the episode and a lot that's unsaid, which works to its testament, which actually works to the show's working, I think. I think it actually does actually bring something to it by not releasing too much. But he is an interesting character because, you know, by the time we get to the end of the episode, he's kind of like validated in his belief and his desire to be, you know, kind of like understood. And I think it's a really interesting take on a character which, you know, would normally, as you say, with like a CSI, might be a bit more two-dimensional than what he actually is here, because there is a lot of you know, onus on who he was as a person.
Well, you know, it's funny because I just feel like watching his performance that I always can like get a really strong sense of his backstory. You know, I can almost like have my own flashbacks, and you see this like young idealistic kid, probably from somewhere in the Midwest, you know, football player, patriotic, joins the military, thinks he's going to save the world and make a difference, and then gets, you know, where he was going and realizes that no, nothing is like what he grew up believing it was. It's, you know, it's almost like he's trying to salvage his own illusions, you know, that he can, you know, right these wrongs. And it's funny too, because my brother was in the military. You know, he joined just before the Gulf War. He joined the Marines. He didn't end up in the Marines. He ended up doing a lot of other stuff. But I mean, he didn't end up in Iraq, but or Kuwait. But you know, it's just like that kind of connection just gave me a little bit more connection to the character. But I, you know, it's just like I really understand him. And I think it's a real testament to James Marsden's performance here, because there's so much about him that we don't know, but I think he conveys it really well through his performance.
Yeah, he can, and that's what I say by unsaid, because he's the way that he plays, as you say, you can almost imagine what he was, what was the stuff. I mean, a lot of people will say, and it's right to say, that you get the show Don't Tell things. I mean, stuff like the flags on the wall really kind of like hits it at home. You know, it's that there's something a bit more to this, and I like that they do that quite a bit in this episode. Things like the Marburg virus vaccine that's in the fridge, you know, it, just by using those words without really discussing it, and you know, very briefly going over the Millennium headshot things of bringing back Skull and Bones, you know, they don't overtly go, this is what happened two episodes ago, you know, it's or this was going back to the time is now. I do like that they succinctly put these things in without really needing to do that. And it also informs the character of Eric as well, the fact that you've got all of this coming together. That, and you almost feel like in some ways that, especially with Frank and Eric's character, because this is the kind of the next bit really, is that Frank obviously wants to help Eric. But there's also this kind of, you know, they can see, Frank can see Frank within Eric as well. The fact that, you know, he's been touched by this Millennium Group and been affected by it. And there's an element of that kind of kindred spirit kind of thing going on as well.
Yeah, well, they share something in common, you know. I mean,
yeah.
And I think that Frank really plays that well, because it always seems like his appearance on the Art Bell show could be, you know, very cynical and manipulative, but he really opens up and sort of opens his heart. And I think, you know, he earns the trust of this character, you know, unfortunately for the character, right? But you know, that wasn't Frank's intent. But yeah. I just, again, this is all, everything's humming and nothing, you know, it's not like, you know, Chris Carter scripts have a tendency to, you know, characters will just sort of sit there and explain the story to each other, you know, like the old exposition dump kind of thing. I think the writing here is really effective in the fact that so much is said without needing to say, and I know you're feeling this and this, and I know this happened to you. And then you did this. You know, like,
yeah. Yeah.
But
it's just not how people speak, but
yeah. And it just really comes over well. And, you know, I think that Michael Perry, I know you had sort of given him a bit of a kicking for the 13 years later debacle, but I don't really blame that on him. You know, I don't think that's his fault. I think that's sort of Fox's fault for forcing Kiss on this show that they really didn't belong in.
Yeah, I mean, but also as well, if I was on some of the other episodes that he's done, I mean, this one obviously is really up there as one of the best as well. So it's nice that we've got an episode where, you know, it's at that one I'm talking about because I didn't get to speak on the other one. But it's just the fact that, you know, this is here, you know, this is within his grasp, and this is really succinct and as tightly done, and it works really well. And I think that, you know, this is the kind of thing I want to see Michael R. Perry done. And I get what you're saying. I totally understand the 13 years later thing, because it's I think hopefully I won't be renowned for the diss on that, but never mind. What about Frank then with his empathy? Is because again, Lance Henriksen, it goes without saying, I don't think we even need to mention it because otherwise we'd be saying it every week, his acting is superb. But he really comes across towards the back end of this episode. Typical Frank, you know, no guns. He just wants to go in there. He wants to talk. I've got no gun. I'm coming in. That kind of aspect to him. But there is a bit of a kind of a feeling here that, as well as Frank's empathy and his willingness to, look, this story needs to be told, there's a little bit of, this is a way in for me to reveal the desire to expose the group as well. And it's played beautifully the way he does that in this end scene at the house.
Well, you know, one of the things that I think of, and I don't think maybe most fans would think about this, but, you know, you think like Frank is being brave and empathetic, but I also think he's got kind of a death wish too. You know, I know that sounds kind of strange to say, but, you know, the way he would sort of throw himself unarmed into all these dangerous situations, you know, I always got the sense, this seems like a funny thing to say, but it, you know, Frank has just seen so much death and he's just so beaten down by life and just has seen too much horror to really, you know, more than one person should ever have to experience, that he's just like, ah, oh, well, whatever. If this guy shoots me, he shoots me, you know?
Yeah. He's had four breakdowns by this point.
Yeah. He's really been through the ringer. So it almost seems like his bravery is like a function of a man with nothing left to lose, you know? I mean, other than, you know, what he values most, which is his relationship with his daughter, but.
Yeah.
You know, even that, you kind of get the sense that, like, well, you know, she'll probably do better without me.
So what do you think to the crescendo then, this end episode, this end of the episode where, you know, Mabius appears and disappears back into the woods, and is allowed to, and I would say allowed to very kind of, you know, abstractly, to deliver what Eric Swan's been wanting to hear. So Watts actually has all this information and is able to divulge this, yet only early in the episode he's saying, don't ask me questions that I can't answer. And it's almost like they've given up. It's almost like the beginning of the end for Peter in some ways, because it's like, this is like he's let his emotion overtake him. And the fact that Peter knows the details like instantly. Now, this obviously could be the fact that he's researched it and whatever, but what do you make to this, like, sort of crescendo of Peter eventually telling Eric what he needs to hear?
Oh, I love it. And it's something that you would probably not see in the X-Files, right? They would just like throw a bunch of more mysteries on top of that. But I like it because I think it really gives us another dimension on Peter that we haven't seen, because we're seeing the character through other people's eyes who don't trust him. But, you know, he's willing to essentially put his life on the line to save his daughter's life. And, you know, he's clearly a man of conscience. You know, Peter's problem is that he's a yes man, he's a company man, you know, to a group who are are insane and whose plans are insane. And, you know, we get a much better sense of that towards the end of the season. But I thought it was really touching. You know, I really thought that it was powerful. The only part I really did not like, and I got to tell you something, because this speaks to something that I just hate about pop culture, you know, is the fact that Taylor, you know, sneaks up and snaps the guy's neck, you know?
Yeah.
Like, first of all, that's just so friggin' Hollywood. Like, has that ever happened outside of like a Hollywood movie? You know, like this kind of like ninja James Bond stuff. It's just, that's, you know, if she had stabbed him or shot him or something, that would have been much better. But this whole like, oh, you know, she's La Femme Nikita kind of nonsense. I you know, anytime I see like, you know, first of all, you know, all these actresses are all tiny, right? They're all like 5'1" and they weigh about 60 pounds. And then you see them like beating up like linebackers. It's just, it's so stupid. It's just so, it just, every time I see it, it takes me out of the story. Like I remember watching the Star Trek Discovery pilot, you know, and Michael, whatever her name is like beating up Klingons that are literally twice her body mass.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, not going to happen ever. Stop doing this. I really wish they would stop doing that, because if these characters are like super powered, you know, like they're X-Men or something, okay, that's, you know, you go with it. But if they're just like people, there's no way. You could take somebody who's like the best trained fighter in the world and who's, you know, a 90-pound woman who's, you know, 5 feet tall in her heels, and just put her up against like a mediocre boxer, and she's going to get killed. I mean, there was a, I don't know if you remember this, but there was an MMA fighter, a trans woman named Fallon Fox, and she fought, you know, a cis woman, I guess would be the terminology, and she literally caved her face in, you know what I mean? Because of the muscle differentiate, whatever.
differential.
Whatever the terminology would be. So I just really wish they would stop doing that, you know? It's unrealistic. The implications of it to me, like I think, are dangerous. So if she had like stabbed him with a scalpel or slit his throat or shot him, whatever, that would have been cool. But just this whole, she's all of a sudden a super ninja, which never happens outside of like genre movies or television ever in the universe. Just that was like the one sour note. Like this would have been a 10 for me had that kind of corny sour note not been sounded.
Well, here's a question for you a bit then, because I was going to bring this up anyway, that there seems to be an indication, again, the kind of show don't tell with Taylor, that she's had some sort of training by Peter, that she gets under the car, she defends herself really well in the beginning of the scene.
Yeah, but when do we ever, let me just interrupt you here for a second. When do we ever see Peter, like, you know, slugging it out ninja style? I can't think of any.
We don't know.
You know what I mean? I can't think of any episodes where, like, Peter's like this.
Yeah, it would have come in handy later in the season, but we won't talk about that.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, so this is the kind of thing I'm talking about. Like, okay, so she was like, she had studied, like, Taekwondo or something from the time she was a kid, and she, like, see, that's why I like this whole difference with the teaser, because that was realistic to me. Like, she could have surprised these special forces military guys, right? She could have surprised them momentarily and then crawled under the car or whatever. But that would be kind of the extent of it in a real world situation. And again, like, that's the whole thing with me. Like, she should have, you know, it almost seems like that was the network notes. Like, oh, you know, we got to have like this female empowerment kind of thing. Well, you know, female empowerment is very good, but don't make it the X-Men, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that was what I was going to say, actually, is the fact that you've got the difference between what happened at the beginning, which seemed real and effective. And then you've got this kind of, it's almost like, oh, let's put a shock moment in of like, oh right. She's and I like the concept that she defends herself, or that she knows what she's doing. And, you know, whether that be Peter or not that's trained her or whatever, I don't really need to know that. But the question was, you know, as I say, was it a bit too gratuitous? And I think you've answered my question before I asked it, which is great, because, you know, it could have been done a different way and still be effective, you know, and you know, either like taking him down, whichever way they could do. But yeah, it does feel a bit like, as you say, 24 or John Wick or whatever it may be, you know. So it's it is a slight black note on the episode, really. And then,
but it's only a slight one, right? You know, I mean,
it's only a slight one.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. It doesn't take me out. I was lucky enough that I watched this episode about 2 weeks ago in preparation for recording, and I got to the end, and I didn't get to the end because I thought I remembered what happened, and I completely forgot she did that. It was only today that I watched it. Went, oh, I don't remember that. So it was nice that it was actually good that I remembered that, because otherwise it would have been quite disastrous, because a lot of things happen. But then we get to the table scene, and obviously everything's kind of back to normal. That the Peter Watt family ethic is brought in. We saw this. I'm trying to think of scenes that we've seen with Peter and his family before, because we've seen it in we saw his family in Luminary when he went to go and get Frank. We see this again, and this obviously very, very succinctly at this moment in time foreshadows what's going to happen in a later episode. You might have alluded to it earlier on, and as it being one of your favourite two episodes of the season, and you know, the fact that we get a pull out from the window. But the fact that there is this black mark that's within the Watts family, it's not something that we really delve too much into, but it is an interesting concept that, you know, that Taylor's now got these questions for her dad. And, you know, it's something that kind of plays on that. And again, Peter not really answering the question, which she did with Emma early in the episode.
To me, the implication was, it's like, this was your fault.
Yeah.
You know, this wouldn't have happened to me if it wasn't for you. You know, yeah. And like, he was right. You know, he was willing to do all these horrible things to me to get his message across that, you know, you and your people are bad people and you do bad things. So I just thought that was a really interesting turning point. You know, I think of the season, and certainly like the Millennium Group mythology, you know, because it's just like this stuff. I think we might have, I don't know if I discuss it with you, but, you know, one of my things in the X-Files is that I wish there were like more family stories. You know, I wish there were more, yeah. You know, I wish we saw.
You're going down the Christmas Carol route, haven't you? You've talked about that before.
Yes, yes, yes. So like the whole thing with the Christmas Carol, I wish they did more episodes like that, because what that all does, I know a lot of people think that's boring or whatever, but what it did for me is that it put everything in context, that like all these things that are happening are real and they affect people. You know, like one of the great examples I always use is in Redux 2, the confrontation between Bill Scully and Mulder, where like he, you know, like Bill Scully just like reduces Mulder to tears because he's like, you're destroying my family. And everybody, you know, like there's this whole like thing among the fan community that, you know, Bill Mulder's a dick and everything. But like Bill Mulder to me is like stand up, you know, he's trying to save his family from like this guy who's pretty much everybody sees as a lunatic. Right. So I think that was very grounding. And it puts everything that happens, you know, say in that entire season into a different context, because it shows that there are consequences here. And I think without those episodes, without like that scene that you're talking about at the end of this episode, what are the consequences? You know, what are the effects that this have on real people? And I really enjoyed that. I thought that was a perfect ending to the episode. And it's again this where I just see this as like next level television, because any other show like that would not do that. They would not go there. You know what I mean? First of all, they wouldn't be raising these kind of moral dilemmas in the first place. And second of all, you know, would they have that where you ended on like a very dark note? Like, you know, is it true? You know, And what she isn't just saying is it true that, you know, your group did this to people, but is it true because is it true that it's your fault that yeah. I was kidnapped and tortured? You know, I think that that is, you know, and by a guy who I came to realize was just a man, you know, an honest, decent man who was driven to an extreme because of what you did to him. And I just, you know, again, I just really wish that there was more stuff like that in the X-Files. And maybe this, I think actually, you know what, let me just amend that. I mean, I think the Millennium was better at incorporating those kind of things than the X-Files was in a lot of ways. Cause the X-Files is, you know, it's basically, you know, you've got to sort of serve that genre sci-fi fantasy audience. Right. But, you know, one of the yeah. things I think about is in Sacrament in the first season, you know, and kind of like, you know, there, you could probably draw a lot of parallels between those two episodes. Right. And, you know, we have a very similar scene where Frank's brother is just like, you know, you don't see it, but you know, you bring this upon us, you know, it's your obsessions and your fixation on this darkness that brings it into everyone else's life. And I just think mm-hmm. that was just absolutely, you know, brilliant on Frank's part there. And, you know, you kind of wonder when, like, they're having all these writers meetings and, you know, like Chip and Ken Horton are sort of pitching this stuff to Chris and Frank, you know, and sort of talking it over. You know, you wonder if that there's that kind of elements, you know, like you almost want to, like, Frank says, well, why don't you put this in at the end, you know, like that kind of a deal. It like, again, it does draw back to Sacrament. So again, this is operating on so many different levels, and even though people don't appreciate it today and certainly didn't appreciate it back then, you're just seeing, to me, what is like a masterclass in off-kilter thriller storytelling.
Yeah, I mean, just to kind of focus in on that, because X-Files obviously did do it to some points, and you know, there was elements of the family and whatever, but Darren obviously mentioned the last episode of season one going into the first episode of season three and the bridging of the parents and the consequences of that. And you know, you've got Frank's consequences of what happens in the beginning and the end. You've got the borrowed time, the way that it deals with Jordan, and you know, some of the drama that's aspected there. And I think you're right with Millennium. I think that because it has more time and more opportunities to do that, then it does have a bit more solid foundation in that regard. And the Bill Scully thing is really interesting, because you know, it is off-putting, because you know, Bill, to a lot of ways, is right. You know, you're right. He kind of, you know, you're doing this to my family, you know, and you need to look at yourself. And it works, because you're watching it from Mulder's point of view, and Mulder's having to deal with that issue. You know, it's all about his introvertedness of, you know, what have I done to Scully? How have we got to this point? And no one really takes Mulder to task a lot of the times. He does get it during the course of seasons. But, you know, the fact that Bill Scully was raised for that, and Darren's argued that that's probably where the Catherine kind of story, bringing the parents into it with the consequences of Catherine's death at the beginning of season three. So it's a really interesting aspect of the show, and be interesting to see if there's anything further into the season.
Yeah, and again, I mean, I'm just thinking back on like maybe shows that were sort of working in similar genres or themes before Millennium, you know, just sort of your better quality cop or lawyer or whatever kind of shows that you would have on network television that would have some really good writing. But just that whole idea of, these moral dilemmas and this kind of compromise that comes about when you sacrifice your morals for some hypothetical greater good.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's why I really, really enjoy Peter's arc this season, because that's really what his arc is about. It's about a guy who basically allows himself to become a monster because he thinks the ends justify the means. And it's not till the end, you know, that he realizes that he's just been terribly, terribly wrong.
Yeah.
And this, and so we're going to talk about, you know, Goodbye to All That and Via Dolorosa. And I'm really looking forward to that. But it almost seems to me like this episode is almost like the first part of that. Like you could take this episode and put it together with those other two episodes and really get this nice arc, you know, like Peter's arc and then the arc of the moral compromise of the Millennium Group and just how bad and how wrong it goes. Because, you know, I think there's a real truth to that because, you know, moral crusaders so often become monsters, right? Or they become oppressors themselves. Like liberators, how often do we see that liberators become oppressors? I mean, people forget that the mafia was, you know, rose up in an opposition to the French occupation of Sicily, right? So it's like this happens time and time again that liberators become oppressors. And when you add in the factor of like all this eschatology and apocalypticism and just this kind of stark religious theology, you know, that's always going to just sort of accelerate that process. So again, I mean, I keep saying that like this is television that has not aged, you know, and even though like we might not see like necessarily these themes play out in the same context of like, you know, Christian eschatology, you know, you still have like true believers, you know, whether the cause is political or social or somehow, you know, that are infected by the same virus, so to speak. You know, they're infected by the same virus where self-righteousness and moral narcissism inspires evil acts in the name of the greater good.
I think that's a perfect way to the end of the episode as well. I think it's certainly an interesting one. And I think you're right with the putting this one with Via Dolorosa and Goodbye to All That, because as I say, I alluded to the fact that we've got this window and scene. Now, whether or not that is foreshadowing or it's something that they may have done, you know, and come back to is anyone's guess really. But you could quite easily put those three together. Is there anything else that you wanted to bring up? Anything that you've got within your notes? Anything like that you wanted to mention before we have a very quick look into the mailbag?
No, I just think that you should watch this episode. If you've been resistant to season three, I think that this is an excellent place to start. Like if you're into season three and you want to get somebody into it and sort of say, well, listen, you might have had it all wrong. Let's watch this episode and see how you feel about this. And then we'll take it from there. Like this would be to me, like just a great episode to show somebody how good the season could be.
Okay. So let's have there's only three comments, but let's have a very quick look into this week's mailbag. Okay, so Tony Black has been on. He says, ah, yes, the episode that brings Millennium and the X-Files into the Buffy extended universe. This might just be my headcanon. Fair enough. Tabby Abduskias, I apologise if I've completely destroyed your name, and they've just put, damn it, Spike. And then we've got Mio Fug, and they say, Frank and Peter back together. It's peak Millennium. Starting out as a seemingly serial killer of the week episode and then plot twists into something more interesting. The conflicted Dwayne Barry-esque vet and more Millennium Group conspiracy make for great TV. So they are fans of season three. I think, you know, it's been interesting going through the whole of the three seasons and actually talking to people on not only on the show for season three, but even like as early as the pilots and you know, talking to people as we've gone through, and I'm hoping that there will be this reevaluation of episodes, and we're trying to do it as much justice as possible.
Well, you see, you know, I think the good thing about it, you know, this whole thing though is that, you know, in your show and the podcast and the group and everything, is this is like very much grown up Millennium. You know, this isn't like the horror movie millennium of season one, and this isn't like sort of that like Da Vinci Code millennium of season two. This is like very real world, very grounded, very well researched, you know, people acting like adults and having sort of adult reactions to crisis. You know, I think the fact that, you know, people getting older and having a little bit more life experience under their belt is going to help. I think it's going to really help open up the season for them. Like I said, again, I mean, yeah. I didn't watch the season until 2005, you know, when I was nearly 40 years old. So I just saw it differently than like, you know, kids who were X-Files fans and then got into Millennium in high school or whatever would have. You see what I mean?
Yeah. No, absolutely. It's certainly interesting. It's been interesting reevaluating even myself, because I rewatched this maybe 3-4 years ago, and season three was a season that I'm always open to watching, you know, shows, and I tend to watch them right through to the end, and it had its moments for me. I mean, like I've said in the past on various other recordings. But it was nice to go through season three before I knew I was doing this podcast, because it was like I had a chance to actually reevaluate that before and not come into the podcast with an idea of what it was when I watched it when I was 20. I would have been about 20, 1999, yeah. So I'd have been 19, 20 years old when I watched this. So having that reevaluation at, say, so that would have been 36, 37 years old, it does have that aspect of like, oh, it's nice and that I've kind of developed my own kind of history, that I know of the things that I kind of like and I've grown to like more, and then to be able to do the podcast with more of an open mind to it, it's helped me actually understand it more. And even by going through this week in, week out now, it's been fantastic to be able to do that. We've been both struggling with voices today, yeah. So I apologise, which is unusual for me. I don't normally have a struggle. I think it must be my work. But yeah, so I think it's really good. But so that does bring the episode to a close. You'll be, as I say, we'll be on The Sound of Snow next week on episode 12, which is something that people can look out for with Darren joining our group for that episode. So until then, where can people find you online, and what have you been up to, and what delights can people get if they want more Chris Knowles?
You should check out my novel, He Will Live Up in the Sky, the greatest novel written in the English language, bar none, and I say that purely objectively. You can get it on Amazon. And I'm going to have sort of a companion book coming out soon called The Endless American Midnight, which is sort of a non-fiction companion to the book. So that would probably be the best places to start.
Excellent. Well, you can find me at the usual place, at R Muldrake on Twitter. That's R-M-U-L-D-R-A-K-E. Hop over, as we're currently going through season six over on the X-Cast for the X-Files. That's the X_cast. And you can also find me on the Red Dwarf podcast, Shipwrecked, I'm Comatose. And you can find that at Red Dwarf Pod. And we should be getting into some more Star Trek Picard stuff as well over on the Make It So podcast. And you can find that at Jean-Luc Poddard. So those are the best places to find us. As I say, we'll be back next week for The Sound of Snow. But until next time, remember, everyone, this is who we are.
Elsewhere, and We Made This. We are Starfleet.
Star Trek Lower Decks has been a lot of fun so far. Yeah. And, you know, the comedy humor is, I think it's sorely needed in Star Trek right now. Yeah, it's really nice to have such a different tone. I know you didn't like the first few episodes, but, like, I've certainly gotten laughs out of every episode, which is not something that I can say out of every, you know, watching every Star Trek episode. I'll be honest, you know, like, sometimes when I'm actually, like, laughing at a Star Trek episode, it's not because the episode intended me to. it's not something that Star Trek has always done well, comedy.
We Buy Records.
even coming into your shop, I will sometimes spot stuff that you've massively underpriced, and I won't let you know until I get home.
Oh, you're so kind, Paul. Thank you for that. Until you've got it home and then flipped it on to somebody else on Twitter for four times the price, which you have done.
I should just point out, if you collect jungle or hardcore, you should definitely nip into Tim's, because that's the section he always seems to manage to gnaws up.
The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast.
The teaser, you know, we get the sun, I think, is the main thing.
Oh, you missed the previously.
Previously on. Yeah, because we get the movie stuff. That was so exciting. Like, oh, the movie.
And I wonder if that sets them up for a bit of a fail here, because we see the big spaceship. And then this has to be a bit more kind of, you know, closed in by comparison, doesn't it? Because, you know, because of the budget and so on. But yeah, that's a good point, Kurt. Yeah, well made.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black and is produced by Tony Black and Kurt North. We can be found on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod or by searching Facebook for The Time Is Now. We are part of the We Made This podcast network, which can be found on Twitter at We Made This Pod or on the website WeMadeThisPod.com. For bonus material and exclusives, check out our sister show, The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast, where you can find our Patreon. This is who we are.